From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My words are not sufficient enough to express my deep hurt as a result of my co-defendants and my foolishness and our action, our ignorance that brought about the pain of the Dorfler family, our own families.
The voice of Tyrone Gilliam, executed last night in Maryland. We'll have a live report from Baghdad, and reporter Robert Fisk will talk about the Middle East. Ecuadorian indigenous communities bring a class action suit against Texaco. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations weapons monitors returned to Baghdad today, a week after leaving to avoid threatened U.S.-led airstrikes on Iraq. The inspectors flew to Habaniya Military Air Base, west of Baghdad, on U.N. transport plane from Bahrain. They then drove in three buses and three cars to U.N. headquarters on the outskirts of Baghdad. About 120 U.N. aid workers returned to Baghdad earlier today after a 600-mile journey across the desert from the Jordanian capital of Amman. One of the first documents that Baghdad is expected to be told to hand over to UN weapons inspectors is one listing the amount of ordnance capable of being filled with chemical or biological agents that it expended during its 1980-88 war with Iran. The document's been at the center of a tug of war since July between Iraq and UNSCOM, the UN Special Commission in charge of scrapping its weapons of mass destruction. This news from the West Bank. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat today disavowed violence and backed off plans to declare independence in May in an effort to resolve the latest crisis with Israel. Arafat's clarifications came a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suspended Israel's troop withdrawal from the West Bank. Netanyahu said he would not hand over 2% of the West Bank by the end of the week as scheduled until Arafat retracted his announcement that he would establish a Palestinian state. The Israeli cabinet is to decide today whether to give the go-ahead for the pullback, and all Israel is to hand over 13% of the West Bank by the end of January, according to terms agreed upon at the Y Plantation Accords. House Democrats yesterday readied a rough welcome for independent counsel Kenneth Starr, whose politically charged testimony later this week will kick off impeachment proceedings against President Clinton. Democrats asked Starr in a letter to provide a variety of documents on the early stages of his investigation, which they hope will bolster their accusations that he stepped over the line in his pursuit of Clinton. Starr will be the first and so far only impeachment witness when he appears Thursday before the House Judiciary Committee, which is conducting an inquiry stemming from Clinton's affair with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. Also today, tapes are expected to be released of conversations with Monica Lewinsky by Linda Tripp. This news from Maryland. Tyrone Gilliam, who is on death row, was executed last night. We'll have more on that story later in the show. And from California, a federal judge yesterday blocked the execution of a prisoner who once trained as a Buddhist monk just hours before he was to die by injection for killing two people during a robbery in 1981. U.S. District Judge Maxine Chesney said California Governor Pete Wilson's office may have misled Jeturin Sirapong's lawyers about what information Wilson would consider in deciding whether to grant clemency and reduce his sentence to life without parole. Chesney issued a temporary restraining order blocking the execution until she decides whether Wilson must reconsider clemency. This news from New York, three police officers accused of torturing a Haitian immigrant in a station house bathroom face new charges of obstruction of justice. In a federal indictment announced yesterday, Thomas Bruder, Charles Schwartz, and Thomas Wies were accused of plotting to conceal Schwartz's role in the brutal beating and sexual assault of Abner Louima. From Washington, U.S. states yesterday unveiled details of a $206 billion agreement to settle their lawsuits against tobacco firms, including sweeping curbs on advertising and measures to cut teen smoking. The deal, which would be the largest ever settlement of a civil lawsuit, was negotiated by eight states and requires the support of several more states to take effect. From Indonesia, flanked by Indonesia's current and former armed forces commanders, the dictator, B.J. Habibie, appeared on national television yesterday and accused his opponents of orchestrating street protests that ended with the military shooting deaths of at least 8 students by the military. Police said they have interrogated 11 opposition figures, including 2 retired generals. Human rights activists say the government's trying to create scapegoats for the bloodshed as calls mounted for Habibie and military boss General Wiranto to quit. A British court said today the government must decide by December 2nd if it's to proceed with Spain's request to extradite former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. And finally, New York City Mayor Giuliani's film office has barred Roger and Me filmmaker Michael Moore from shooting his TV satire on city streets, saying he must first resolve a harassment suit filed by a target of the show. Moore recently shot segments poking fun of the New York City mayor. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a few minutes, we're going to hear directly from Baghdad in a report by Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill, and then we'll be joined by independent newspaper reporter Robert Fisk talking about the implications of what's going on in the Persian Gulf now for all of the Middle East. And we're going to hear from Tyrone Gilliam himself, some of his last words before he was executed, a news conference that was organized by an anti-death penalty group that he held over the phone. We'll play some of those recordings. But right now, a federal district court judge will be hearing arguments today on a class action suit against Texaco brought about by indigenous communities from Ecuador's Amazon basin. The plaintiffs charge Texaco with ruining their rivers and land, causing widespread devastation to the rainforest environment and creating a dramatically increased risk of cancer for tens of thousands of people. According to attorneys for the plaintiffs, damages could exceed $1 billion. The case is being heard today by Judge Jed Rakoff, a federal district court judge in New York who dismissed the case earlier but had his decision overturned by a higher 3-judge panel. Judge Rakoff is to decide whether the case will be tried in the U.S. or will be referred to Ecuadorian courts. Plaintiffs in the case are using an obscure law of the 1700s that was used to prosecute pirates. And if their legal tactics are successful, the case could set an important precedent for groups trying to sue companies for environmental damages in the countries where the companies are based. We're joined right now by Joseph Cohn. He is lead prosecutor in the Texaco case about to go to court. And on the telephone with us, Chris Josnick. He's coordinator for Latin America at the Center for Economic and Social Rights, joining us from Quito, Ecuador. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Joseph Cohn. You're about to head into court. What is going to be your argument today?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you very much. It was just about 5 years ago to the day, November 93, that we filed this action in New York. We were accompanied by some of the chiefs of the Indian communities that were affected by Texaco's conduct. They came to New York dressed in their traditional tribal clothing to try to seek justice against one of the largest corporations in the world, Texaco. And we came to where Texaco lives. And for the last 5 years, we've been fighting a battle where Texaco has made the incredible argument that it is so inconvenient for it to defend a case in New York, where its corporate headquarters is, that the case should be dismissed and thrown out. In October, just a month ago, the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit reinstated the case, and we're going to go over to court in a few minutes this morning to try to get this case on a schedule to bring out the facts and to prove our claims and to seek recovery from Texaco, which will send a message to multinationals in the oil industry and others that you simply cannot trash parts of the world and get away with it, that there will be justice. People will come to the courts in your own country and seek that recovery. I think when Texaco was drilling for oil and actually spilled more oil in the rainforest of Ecuador than was spilled in the Exxon Valdez disaster, they never thought in a million years that the Kofani people and the other indigenous people would see to it to come to the federal court in New York to seek justice.
Explain exactly what the case is, who it is you're representing, and what they are claiming.
The suit was filed by 79 individuals, men, women, and children, who live in the rainforest of Ecuador, whose communities were essentially destroyed by years of oil exploration and drilling practices initiated by Texaco. They're also seeking to represent what we call a class action, which would be everyone in the Oriente region of Ecuador, which was affected by this practice. They're seeking recovery not only for the damage to their land, to the water that they would drink and bathe in, but also for the injuries that they have suffered. The evidence is horrific. Children walking barefoot through fields where oil bubbles up from the ground, their bodies covered in oil, using gasoline that sits in open drums to wipe the oil and tar off their bodies. And this is something that, that frankly, Texaco cannot get away with.
As I said, we're also joined by Chris Josnick, coordinator for Latin America at the Center for Economic and Social Rights based in Quito, Ecuador. What kind of attention is this case getting in Ecuador, Chris?
Since it was filed 5 years ago, the case has helped enormously in terms of raising the profile of oil problems generally down here in Ecuador. 8 years ago or 6 years ago when Texaco left in 92, there was very little discussion about the environmental or social problems that are occasioned by oil. And today, it's a constant theme in the media, whether it's Texaco or Occidental or any of a number of companies. Today, it's a big issue. So it certainly raised awareness. It's also put a lot of companies on notice so that today you don't get the same kind of abuses because it's just more difficult for companies to get away with that sort of thing in that area of Ecuador. Whereas in the past, many of these harms were hidden. Today, there are groups, NGOs, and also the communities are better organized to ensure that any sort of problems are immediately reported in the media and that Congress is more aware and that the various ministries that are presumably overseeing oil are also more aware and more attentive to these issues. So it certainly helps on all of those fronts.
Now, the Ecuadorian government was not always behind this suit. Joseph Cohn, can you explain?
Early in the case, there was a division in the Ecuadorian government. An ambassador to the United States from Ecuador requested the United States State Department to support the position of Texaco, that the matter should be dismissed. Our State Department declined to do so. At the same time, congressional leaders in Ecuador were very supportive of the case. And actually, the treaties between the United States and Ecuador support the rights of citizens of either country to go to courts in the other country and to seek redress. And many of the political leaders in Ecuador were supportive of the rights of their people to seek recovery against Texaco because you could not sue Texaco in Ecuador. Texaco is no longer doing business in Ecuador. So the Texaco wanted to have it both ways. Don't sue us. You can't sue us in the United States and you can't sue us in Ecuador. Later, the government of Ecuador became united, and the executive branch, as well as the congressional branch, filed papers with Judge Rakoff and then ultimately with the Court of Appeals, taking that position that the case should proceed here.
Since Judge Rakoff originally ruled, actually dismissed the case, saying it should be heard in Ecuador, what chance do you have with him today? I mean, it's not him who said it should be heard. It's a three-judge panel who sent it back to him.
Well, under our system, those judges are the boss, as it were. We are hopeful to get the case on a schedule. Judge Rakoff is a capable trial judge, and all we want is a trial.
I should say that we did ask Texaco, called their headquarters in White Plains, and asked them to join us in this conversation, and they declined that offer. What about the precedent-setting nature of this case? What would it mean for other cases? And explain this law from the 1700s that allows you to bring this suit in a U.S. court.
Yeah, the law is called the Alien Tort Statute. It gives the foreigners the rights to come to the United States and sue when there's been violations of international law. Our office has actually been involved in one of the cases to go to trial under that law against the estate of Ferdinand Marcos, who was a dictator and then came to the United States, and he was sued here by thousands of torture victims where there had been state-sponsored torture instituted by Marcos. The same principles apply to this kind of wanton, outrageous environmental contamination. It violates international law, it violates international standards, and the United States will not be a hiding place for individuals or corporations that behave that way. our courts will be a place where people from throughout the world can seek justice against that kind of conduct. This case is a wake-up call, certainly to Texaco, and as Chris mentioned, from Ecuador to the other oil companies planning to or drilling in the Amazon and throughout the world. There are international standards for protecting our environment. We're in a very, very small world. What happens in the North Sea or in the jungles of the Amazon ultimately are going to affect all of us.
Mm-hmm. Under that law, the Alien Tort Claims Act, it's possible that Pinochet could be extradited right here to the United States. Is that right? Or at least if he came to the United States, be sued.
Certainly if he came here, I would question whether that's one of the reasons he is not here. There have been a history of cases against not only Marcos, but other dictators under that law, including some of the dictators now in the Balkans.
Chris Josnick, what about the environmental groups in Ecuador and the level of involvement with indigenous groups there and the press coverage of this case?
Well, there are two themes to this case. One is all of the legal issues that you've certainly delved into with Joe. I think it's also very important to underscore what this case represents in terms of community organizing and the community struggle down here in Ecuador. As I said, 6 years ago, oil really wasn't an issue. And today, because these groups in the Amazon had no other recourse, their government wasn't protecting them in any way, the oil companies certainly weren't concerned about them, they've largely taken these issues into their own hands and on many occasions have actually taken over government offices. One of the first times that the government actually supported the case arose directly from a takeover where about 50 members of the Amazon came into Quito and sat in the office until the Attorney General agreed to change the government's position and actually travel to New York to support the case. So this case really has woken up a lot of community action, and it's a very positive development in that sense, because today, instead of the situation where 6 years ago you hardly had any discussion and hardly any groups working on it, so you have a very organized network of groups that involves the local church, the universities, the local schools, community groups, some think tanks, environmental groups certainly, and the indigenous federations. And all of them are very, very aware of what's happening in the case and very ready to dialogue with Congress or insist that the minister come out to review the damages and those sorts of actions. And that has really taken a lot of work on the part of these groups, and the Texaco case in that sense has been very helpful in providing a focus, and also because Texaco has been so arrogant and the damages are so extreme, it's also provided a very useful rallying call in some ways for this sort of organizing. So in that sense, the case has been very positive despite the problems that it has encountered in the U.S. I should also mention that the case is not only limited to the company and to the Ecuadorian government. The U.S. government also has somewhat of a shameful history in this, in that for 25 years, the U.S. government sat by passively allowing or watching and even supporting, in many ways, the embassy down here supports oil companies, and allowing this sort of damage to go on, knowing that it's lethal to the environment and to the communities, and that none of these practices would be allowed in the U.S. And the only time that they've happened to get involved in the case was 2 years ago when the Attorney General from Ecuador was wavering about whether he was going to support the case. He alerted us to the fact that the U.S. Embassy had visited him to try to persuade him not to change the government's position and not to support the case. And so that you have this array of forces working against these isolated communities that involves the oil companies, Texaco certainly, which is four times more powerful than this government in terms of its annual revenues. You have the U.S. government, the U.S. embassy, and the communities are largely left to their own devices with a few NGOs, poorly financed NGOs, trying to help them in some way.
Chris Josnick, if people want to get in touch with the Center for Economic Social Rights, you are in Quito, Ecuador, but the group is based in New York. What is their phone number?
212-634-3424. 212-634-3424.
Well, thank you very much for joining us from Quito, and thank you very much to Joseph Cohn, who heads right off to court right now to present arguments in a class action suit against Texaco on behalf of indigenous communities from Ecuador's Amazon basin. Again, I'm sorry that Texaco refused to join us today. I also want to let you know, just before we go to our break, that the documentary that Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill and I did on Chevron in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta, will be replayed on Thanksgiving. That's November 26th. It's called Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. Up next, we get a live report from Jeremy from Baghdad. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In just a minute, we'll be joined by independent newspaper reporter Robert Fisk, usually based in Lebanon, Beirut-based reporter for the last 20 years. He's in the United States right now. But first, we turn to Baghdad, where Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill is. As we report at the top of the program, United Nations weapons monitors have returned to Baghdad a week after leaving to avoid threatened U.S.-led airstrikes on Iraq. Jeremy Scahill, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
So tell us what is happening in Baghdad right now.
Well, the things here remain very tense, very touch and go, and you know, very few people around Baghdad believe that the situation is resolved. Yes, in fact, the UNSCOM inspectors did return to Baghdad today. I was out there on the outskirts of Baghdad when they came in. More than 50 reporters and cameramen had gathered there, along with a couple of dozen Iraqi soldiers, to await their return. Banners across the street from UNSCOM headquarters were put up. They said, "To UNSCOM, you are in our country to cover the greatest crime in history," which was an obvious reference to the U.S. using UNSCOM as a justification for a potential bombing campaign. Other signs read, "You are here to kill our children." Of significance, one of the first vehicles to enter the compound was that of Hans von Spanik, the man who replaced Dennis Halliday as the U.N. humanitarian coordinator. And then following him came a convoy of more than 10 UNSCOM vehicles that sort of trickled in. Some of them were carrying equipment, and others were buses that were carrying the inspectors themselves. Also entering the compound were more of the humanitarian workers who were returning to work. And it's interesting to note the difference in demeanor between the humanitarian workers and the weapons inspectors. The humanitarian workers were very jovial, waved to reporters and other people gathered around. But the weapons inspectors were very stoic and just sort of stared ahead. Tensions here do remain high, and when the UNSCOM spokesperson, Carolyn Cross, came out to speak to reporters, her remarks have some people concerned here. When she came out, she said that the UNSCOM inspectors would spend today in Baghdad unloading their equipment and testing their equipment and getting things ready, but she said they were still awaiting word from New York for instructions. Now, what that was possibly a reference to is the fact that the U.N. Special Envoy to Iraq, who was appointed just a couple of weeks ago, Prakash Shah, he is heading to New York to meet with Kofi Annan. He is sort of like Kofi Annan's man on the scene here. And he's going to be returning to New York for instructions from the United Nations. And this seems to be a very strong indication that things are not resolved. They are still awaiting instructions. They have returned, but tensions are still very high here all across Baghdad. And the city really does remain in a very tense state of emergency. I think very few people believe that this is resolved, but rather believe that things are touch and go and that the United States could decide to bomb at any time.
Jeremy, as you've arrived over the last few days, you've had a chance to talk with a number of Iraqis. What is the attitude to the U.S. government as well as to Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think that the attitude to the U.S. government is, and as it's been expressed to myself and other American citizens that I'm traveling here with from the group Voices in the Wilderness, a Chicago-based group against the sanctions, is that they draw a distinction between the American people and the American government. There is a lot of curiosity as to why the United States government is threatening their country, and people come up to us all the time and literally are begging for mercy, asking us, please, please tell your government not to bomb us. We are already suffering. We are already dying. Please, please tell them not to bomb us. It does not hurt our government. It hurts us. It hurts the people. As regards to the views toward Saddam Hussein, it's very difficult. People are not openly talking about Saddam Hussein. A lot of people will say that they support him and that they're behind him, but you really don't hear from people any criticism of the government here. But you certainly hear a lot of criticism of the United States government. Things that range, Scott Ritter's name is mentioned a lot here, and people will spit on the ground. Scott Ritter, one of the sort of celebrity weapons inspectors, nicknamed the Fox, who was a U.S. intelligence agent who was sent over here with the UNSCOM team, and of course the Iraqi government has officially accused him of being a spy. So there's a lot of animosity towards Scott Ritter, and it's interesting, people here are comparing how much media coverage Scott Ritter gets in comparison to Dennis Halliday, who resigned in protest saying that he could no longer take it, that so many children were dying as a result of U.S.-UN policy. He resigned in protest, and Scott Ritter resigned because he said that they weren't doing enough, and he was advocating more what the United States is advocating, which is the use of force against Iraq and a much tougher line on Iraq. But the Iraqi people feel that the line is already tough enough, that too many of their children have died, too many of their elderly have died, and that their hospitals are essentially a death row for children and the elderly.
Again, UN reports saying 8,000 people a month die in Iraq as a result of the sanctions. Jeremy Scahill, how easy is it for you to move around? Are you free to move around? Does the Iraqi government care where you go?
Yes, I have been free to move around and to speak with people. I have done a little bit of traveling with the press corps, with people from CNN and the BBC, Voice of America, the Associated Press, and I've also done some moving around on my own. It's interesting to note that I don't believe a lot of the cameramen are going into the hospitals here in Iraq or are necessarily really covering the suffering brought upon by U.S.-UN policy. I have felt very free to move around and to talk to people. And it's interesting, I spoke with an Iraqi reporter this morning as we were waiting for the convoy to enter the U.N. compound on the outskirts of Baghdad. And he was pointing out to me that when the United States passed the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act of 1998, that the U.S. made two exceptions, that the president can declare inspections off limits for reasons of national security, and that the United States is allowed to object to certain inspectors. These are two of the exact complaints of the Iraqi government, and he was just noting that it was very ironic that the United States was pushing this so much and, in fact, had a very similar policy itself.
Jeremy, last comments on this report from Baghdad. Of course, we're going to have you back each day bringing our listeners live reports. While the media may suggest that, at least for this moment, the threat of attack is over this week, clearly what we're doing on Democracy Now! Is looking at that continued war, which is the sanctions, which is something that many say could be as bad, are as bad in terms of number of deaths as bombings.
Well, it's interesting. Members of Voices in the Wilderness who have been on Democracy Now! Several times, this is the group from Chicago that travels regularly to Iraq in violation of United States law and to break the United States, United Nations sanctions. They were out at the UNSCOM scene today as well. And when they were talking to reporters, they were saying that UNSCOM doesn't need to go very far to find weapons of mass destruction, that they only need to go into an Iraqi hospital to see the devastation wrought on children. And the final point that I guess I want to make is that I know that a lot of the media have reported a reduction in force here in the Gulf region that would be aimed at Iraq, but the United States still has an absolutely lethal arsenal capable of launching devastating Tomahawk cruise missiles at the country. There is still a very heavy troop buildup. And the United States has spent more on this almost than they have in a year in its Gulf presence. I mean, they're spending roughly $30 million a day to keep this operation going. So it's still very, very tense here. Particularly at night, people start to get very nervous, and there's just a very nervous energy in the air. So I think that all the reports that this is resolved I think, are very premature, and they're certainly not buying it here in Iraq. They still believe that they are under a direct threat from the United States and, of course, the continuing devastation caused by the sanctions.
Jeremy Scahill, thanks very much for being with us. Stay safe in Baghdad. Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Producer. We'll hear from him again tomorrow. And on that issue of the cost of the military buildup in the Gulf. This I see in the New York Daily News today. Pentagon officials put the cost estimate of the recent buildup at several hundred million dollars. The price tag for sending aircraft carriers, bombers, and troops to the Persian Gulf region last November and again in February ran around $1 billion each. This according to Defense Secretary William Cohen. Hitting Iraq with hundreds of cruise missiles and laser bombs would have added to the bill. The missiles alone cost $1 million each. And if people can tell us what they think should be done with that money, we welcome your comments. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. We're joined right now in our Washington studio at Pacifica Station WPFW by Robert Fisk. He's generally in Beirut and in the Middle East. He is the Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper based in Britain and has repeatedly been voted the best foreign correspondent by British editors. He's in the United States giving a series of talks. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert Fisk.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Well, here you are in the United States, which must give you a different vantage point on what's happening in the Persian Gulf and the U.S. threats against Iraq. Can you give us your impressions, having been in the Middle East for the last 20 years?
It doesn't give me any vantage point at all. If I lived in America, I don't think I'd have the slightest idea what was going on in Iraq, and I certainly wouldn't have found out what lies behind this latest crisis. There's no doubt if you actually talk to people who've been speaking directly to the Iraqi regime. For example, the former Irish Taoiseach Prime Minister, Albert Reynolds, who just over a week ago was actually sitting having dinner in Tariq Aziz's house, Tariq Aziz, Deputy Prime Minister, discussing with him what really lies behind this crisis. People like Albert Reynolds, the former Taoiseach, he is virtually ignored, and yet he was in New York a few days ago, and he knew exactly what did lie behind it. He described to me, in fact, how Tariq Aziz had again and again raised the issue of how, when the Security Council wrote a letter back in October to Secretary General Kofi Annan, they did not include, apparently at America's wishes, a reference which is particularly crucial to the Iraqis, to paragraph 22 of UN Security Council Resolution 687, which talks about a steady lifting of sanctions. Instead of that, the letter only referred to a re-examination of sanctions. And along with Congress's $100 million vote for the Iraqi opposition, it's fairly clear that Saddam Hussein decided that sanctions were never, ever going to be lifted, and therefore it was time, as usual, and it's his policy, to create a new crisis to solve this crisis, which is what happened. But none of this, none of these details of what lay behind the thinking of the Iraqis in any way got into the American mainstream press or television at all. In fact, I found myself at one point, I was up in Montreal, at the very, just before, we keep saying the height of the crisis, it's theatrical, but at some point, I think it was on Thursday of last week, and I was trying to get across the point on Canadian television to a very nice, bright, smart interviewer that this was a problem of America's policies in the Middle East as a whole, the double standards as the Arabs see it of enforcing UN Security Council resolutions against Saddam, but not against Israel and the West Bank and so on. And he suddenly turned to me and said, where does UN prestige stand now in the Gulf? And I said, hang on a second, it's about US prestige now in the Gulf. And his face had that look like my laptop computer does when it says total disk failure, you know? It was impossible to get across this. I mean, one of the big problems here, particularly in the United States, not so much Canada, is that such is the way in which the discourse on Middle East politics has been framed. The series of beasts that have been set up, you know, is Ayatollah Khomeini, Abu Nidal, Saddam, Osama bin Laden, all the sort of public enemies number one, such as the kind of Wild West scenario, fantasy scenario that's been built around this whole region, such as the language of State Department spokesmen and State Department correspondents who are virtually interchangeable now, that it's virtually impossible, either one, to find out in the United States what is actually going on in the region, and two, to actually discuss it, because the very language in which you discuss these issues, and this applies to the West Bank, Gaza, Syria, Israel, Palestinians, the very language in which one is supposed to discuss these things, peace processes, putting things on back on track, forces of hate, terrorism, the very words have become dead. They've become a kind of prison. And when you try and explain what you mean, even in the English language, a vague sort of glassy-eyed effect comes over one's the recipients of one's words. It simply isn't possible to have, in many ways, in this country, I think, a serious discussion about the issues anymore.
We are listening to Robert Fisk, who is a reporter with the Independent newspaper. What about conversations you have with your colleagues on reporting in the Middle East? What do you think is the essential ingredient missing when you see U.S. coverage of what's going on in the Persian Gulf?
Courage. Journalistic courage. That's what's missing here. 100%. There is no guts in the reporting of the Middle East. No attempt at all to take on the serious issues. The fear of offending Israel or Israel's allies, the fear of appearing contrary to American foreign policy, the idea that to be nonconformist or to suggest that the Americans are completely wrong is in some way unpatriotic. I don't know what causes this. Is it because journalists think that journalism is a kind of the job they have to pay the rent? Or is it because they don't realize it should be a vocation? I don't know the answer, and I don't want to sound priggish or arrogant about it. There are American journalists who try to do their job. But I couldn't help thinking when I was listening to your colleague there in Baghdad that back in February, I was in Iraq just a month ago, but back in February for the last crisis since the last greatest crisis since the last greatest crisis, back in February, I remember actually turning to one of my American news agency colleagues, and I'd just come back from doing 6 hours of interviews and photographs with children who were dying of cancers, children who may, by the way, have actually contracted various cancers from the Allied use of depleted uranium shells during the 1991 Gulf War. And I turned to my colleague and I said, listen, you should see what I've just seen in the hospitals. You should see these kids dying and look at the pictures I've just taken. He said, oh, Bob, I'm not doing baby stories. And it had become a kind of joke that if you were a real fool, you'd go off to the hospitals and cover dying kids. And I don't know, I think in, you know, 20, 30 years to time, if when the United States perhaps can come out of this sort of cloud or this miasma of not dealing with the issues, people might look back and say, hey, we should have done that. But of course, that's easy to do. I think the real problem is that again and again, you find that the language, as I say, the language of Secretary of State Albright and Bill Cohen, it's couched in this very, very infantile discourse. I mean, you should see the number of, you do hear it yourself, the number of reports, the number of statements made, whether it be Joseph Sisko or anyone else, that encourage the idea that this is about the Wild West, this is about Western history, showdowns, shootouts, will you blink first, this is the gunfight at the OK Corral. You remember right back to the days of Ronald Reagan when he said of Gaddafi, he can run but he can't hide, etc., the mad dog of the Middle East. We had Time magazine last week, Joseph Joffe, go back to High Noon, where in the end Gary Cooper had to slug it out with the bad guys all by himself. I mean, High Noon is fiction. Gary Cooper is a fantasy sheriff. Actually, if you remember High Noon, it's about the sheriff who has seduced the gangster's moll, and the gangster is going to take his revenge on the city. That's what he's actually about, and that's, in fact, much more parallel to U.S. policy at the moment. But, this whole language of dealing with the Middle East has become so infantilized or infantilized or whatever, however you like to pronounce it, that it's almost impossible now, I think, to have a comprehension of the issues involved. America is or is not about to go to war again at some point without its people understanding why.
You're listening to Robert Fisk talking about the Middle East. What about the implications of what the U.S. is doing with Iraq now for the rest of the Middle East? I'm looking at a news report that just came over around Algeria calling for a lifting of sanctions against Iraq as a reward for Baghdad's 11th hour promise to cooperate with U.N. arms inspectors.
Look, I think you have to realize that for most Arabs, and we're not talking about Arab leaders who are mostly tin pot dictators with torture chambers and very unpleasant secret policemen. For most ordinary Arabs, Iraq is a very important country. The reason is that it is the only Arab country that has both water and oil. The Arab world is filled with countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, that have lots of oil and absolutely no water, so they're not fertile. They're not independently able to stand alone. And lots of countries like Lebanon and Syria, which has got a lot of water, and absolutely, or virtually no oil. So Iraq is the potential economic social paradise if it got its act worked out. In physical terms, it was approaching that before the war with Iran in 1980. The fact that it became a poverty-stricken trap is largely, of course, the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq war due to Saddam Hussein's own arrogance and madness, political and, I suspect, psychopathic. But the fact of the matter is Iraq is a very important place to Arabs, and they are watching it being crushed and destroyed by the United States. They are well aware of the cull of its people and its children because of sanctions. I don't know about the million children dead, by the way. I've done a lot of research into the number of children who are dying, and it's a massive amount, but a million, I'm still not certain. That is not a UN figure, I believe. I think it's a Harvard figure, and I'm not sure that Harvard was correct in that. However, let's not get involved into whether it's 800,000 or 600,000. That becomes a kind of obscenity. The fact is that Arabs realize very well what is going on in Iraq. They realize the suffering of ordinary Arabs. They are then turning...
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to be back with you in just a minute. Robert Fisk of the Independent Newspaper, he's a Beirut-based foreign correspondent, has been in Lebanon for the last 20 years. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After we hear from him, we're going to hear some of the last public words of Tyrone Gilliam, executed last night in Maryland. Stay with us.
What gets my goat? What gives me pain? Breaks up my crown, fills me with shame. Heats up my blood, drives me insane. Ignore my brothers, they don't treat the same.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Robert Fisk of the Independent Newspaper based in Britain. He is based in Beirut, where he's been for the last 20 years, though he travels throughout the Middle East. And he's in Washington, D.C. now, where he's been giving a series of speeches. You were just talking, Robert, about the way the Arab world views what the U.S. is doing to Iraq.
Yeah, I'll just conclude what I was saying, that they know what's going on in Iraq. They understand how this potentially immensely wealthy country with its water and its oil is being crushed and destroyed. They understand how its people are being are being culled. And then they turn around and they see that Security Council resolutions are not being applied on Israel, like withdrawal from occupied territories. They're seeing the United States effectively lining up with Israel against the Palestinians and allowing the so-called peace process to fall into the grave. They feel betrayed. They feel angry. My understanding, and I'm sure I know this is correct, although, again, it hasn't turned up in the American media, is that when Defense Secretary Cohen went to Saudi Arabia on his pre-crisis or beginning of the crisis trip to try and persuade the Saudis, for the second time, vainly, of course, to let U.S. Aircraft take off from Saudi air bases, Crown Prince Abdullah said to him, not only can you not use your aircraft from our air bases, but we would rather like you, some of us, and some of us, if we had the power, would ask you to take all your air bases away from Saudi Arabia. So, but this, of course, didn't get across, even though I understand from Saudi friends that this is 100% correct. This did not come up. We didn't hear about it. We were told that the Arabs were on side. Again, they were backing the Americans. It's simply not true.
Robert Fisk, I wanted to switch slightly to what's going on right now with Israel and the Palestinians, with Yasser Arafat saying today he's backing off plans to declare independence in May in an effort to resolve the latest crisis with Israel. This coming a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suspended Israel's troop withdrawal from the West Bank. Your comments.
Look, the peace process of Oslo is dead. The final nail in the coffin was at Y, when Arafat accepted that the only principal security that should be safeguarded was Israel's, not Palestinians. The CIA are not there to safeguard Palestinian lives, only Israeli lives. The wording of the peace process is now so vague that both parties can claim the opposite. Arafat can say he's going to have a state. Netanyahu can say that Jerusalem will always be the capital of Israel, that there will never be a Palestinian state. The United States has totally and utterly failed to make any serious political guarantees to the peace process. The Clinton line is, we can bring the parties together, but the hard decisions have to be made by the parties themselves. There's going to be an open conflict very soon between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Many Arabs think that Netanyahu wants a war. I think if he does, he'll get it, but it may not be the kind of war he wants, nor that which the Palestinians would ever wish. In the meantime, we have as Foreign Secretary, the Foreign Minister of Israel, a man who is associated in Arab eyes with one of the worst massacres of 1982, the Sabra and Shatila massacre, but yet nonetheless a man who is still being portrayed in the American press. I'm just looking at an article by my old friend Serge Schmerman here, referring to him as the tough pragmatist with sufficient credibility among settlers and sufficient trust among Arabs. I've never heard an Arab feel anything but hatred towards this man. I'm just not sure, really, where one can... Again, I have the same problem in the United States dealing with the West Bank as I do in the United States dealing with Iraq. The issues are not being discussed here. Israel is on a warpath with the Palestinians. There is going to be a very serious outbreak of violence very, very shortly in the Middle East, unless serious steps are taken by the U.S. administration to actually make the peace work. I don't think the peace can work. I think it's far too late. And I don't think anyway the Americans will do anything. They'll just call on the usual old line from the State Department. They'll call on both sides to exercise restraint. And in the end, they'll sympathize with the Israelis. I think it's a tragic situation. And I think the American response to it is pitiful.
Robert Fisk, joining us from the Independent newspaper. If people want to read your articles and columns in the Independent, where can they go on the web? Do you know it off the top of your head, Robert?
I haven't the slightest idea. I don't have an internet. I don't use it. I don't even have an email site. But all I can tell you is that afterwards I can look it up in my little file and tell it to you, and you can tell your listeners. I'm sorry I missed the opportunity.
We'll do that. No, that's okay. And people can certainly just put in the Independent, and they will be able to find it. But we'll give that at the end of the show. Robert Fisk, thank you very much for joining us, the Beirut-based foreign correspondent for the Independent newspaper, joining us today from Washington, D.C., before he heads back to Lebanon. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we're going to turn to a national issue right now, which is the death penalty and executions. A total of 7 executions have been scheduled this week in the United States, with one taking place last night. As states reduce the number of appeals for condemned prisoners and accelerate the pace of executions, experts on the death penalty warn that it's more and more likely that an innocent person will be killed. This weekend in Chicago, 28 wrongfully convicted people came together at a conference at Northwestern University and reminded the world that the execution of innocent people is inevitable, and that if only for this reason, the death penalty should be abolished. Tyrone Gilliam, who was executed last night in Baltimore, had proclaimed his innocence ever since he was sentenced to death in June of 1989 for the murder of Christine Dorfler. In the last few years of his life, Gilliam was an outspoken advocate of the abolition of the death penalty, and he and his family conducted educational campaigns on the effects of capital punishment on those condemned and their families. Today we bring you his last public words, and they were uttered last week in a phone news conference that was set up by the Campaign to End the Death Penalty. This is Tyrone Gilliam.
To all those who have come to hear and will speak to the injustices of the system. To you all, we are grateful for your advocacy, your sacrifice of your time and your energy. We're grateful for your caring and your sharing, and for providing us with this opportunity to speak with you tonight. And we're grateful to Almighty God Allah for you as well. What brought about a need for this event tonight is my unfortunate participation in the crime which resulted in the untimely death of Miss Christine Dorfler. I am truly, truly repentant for my participation in that crime and the resultant death. My words are not sufficient enough to express my deep hurt as a result of my co-defendants and my foolishness and our ignorance that brought about the pain of the Dorfler family, our own families, and the loss of society. It was nothing but our foolishness and our ignorance that made us take the drugs that we were taking, crack cocaine and PCP. It was our foolishness and our ignorance that made us further impair our already impaired minds. We were spiritually dead, deaf, dumb, and blind. What else could have come out of that type mindset except that which came out of it? That was death, deceit, and deceptive intelligence. Look at the politicians and the judges. Look at the police officers and the teachers and the preachers and the role models. These are people who are looked up to as being intelligent and moral and civilized, but these people have the potential to end life, just as America's so-called criminals. Martin Luther King, I've throughout these Live from Death Row events, I've quoted Martin Luther King Jr. when he said that the most dangerous criminal just may be the man gifted with reason, but no morals. When you look at that statement, a person who is gifted with reason but no morals, being referred to as the most dangerous criminal. We know that a criminal is somebody who does things that are against the law. All criminals are dangerous, but Martin Luther King said that the most dangerous criminal is the person who is gifted with reason but no morals. The Prophet Muhammad, 1,400 years ago, said that reason can bewitch us. It can make us take a position that we normally would not take. The Honorable Minister Farrakhan refers to this as deceptive intelligence. It's like gambling, how people put some type of divine purpose on gambling because it can enable the state to purchase books and restructure schools and build highways. This is deceptive intelligence. When we look at politicians and how they justify killing, how they justify the use of the death penalty, when we look at governors and their rationale in denying clemency petitions when they know that there have been countless violations and cases, we see deceptive intelligence. We see killing. We see people gifted with reason but no morals. And this killing is done for the same reason that they say criminals do it. It's done for a profit. They benefit from death. In the Holy Quran, the book of scripture for Muslims, Allah, God, said that He brings forth death out of life and He brings life out of death. Just as we have the sun and the moon, they do not coexist with one another, but they pursue one another. And of course, it's computed. Their pursuit of one another is excessive. At one time the sun is up, and at another time the moon is up. And death and life are just alike. They do not coexist, but one comes after the other. There is a certain time when one's life must take effect, and there is a certain time when death must take effect. But out of that death, the circumstances that brought it about and those that result from it, if looked at, could be used to produce life. But what kind of life will it produce? For Glendenning, in denying clemency, or with any other governor in denying clemency for political reasons, the life that comes therefrom is a political life. They pivot off of death. They kill for a profit. Flint Gregory Hunt, who was executed on July the 2nd, 1997 in Maryland. His execution was politically motivated. His execution was for the sole purpose of getting the constituency of the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police. Now there's an ability for those who killed him to say, we have the vote of the fraternal order of police. But if that execution did not occur because of the countless violations in this man's case, there would not be a vote from the fraternal order of police. There was a political...
Tyrone Gilliam, in a news conference held last week, a phone news conference with him on death row. Last night, he was executed by the state of Maryland. This after Maryland Governor Glenn Denning denied him clemency. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and as we end the show, we're joined by Michael Stark, who is district coordinator of the campaign to end the death penalty for Maryland and a close friend of Tyrone Gilliam. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Thank you, Amy.
Michael, we just have a minute, but you did speak with Tyrone Gilliam yesterday. What was his last day on earth like?
Tyrone continued to be a source of strength for his family and a source of inspiration for anti-death penalty activists and people trying to rebuild the movement and the fight for justice. Tyrone was incredibly clear and incredibly straightforward in his desire that we turn the tragedy of his death into a fighting alternative to the destruction that's going on in the death penalty, that we rebuild the abolitionist movement and draw strength from it.
Mm-hmm. And can you just very briefly describe this tape, which is really quite something, and it's something that's being done by your organization, the Campaign to End the Death Penalty, with death row prisoners around the country. It was actually a news conference on the phone.
We call them Live from Death Row, taken from the title of Mumia Abu-Jamal's book of the same name. Actually, Gilliam himself was instrumental in creating these forums. We've had them all across the country from Oakland, California, DePaul University in Chicago, up in New York, and across the D.C., Maryland area. What makes them so incredible is we would set up a speakerphone on a campus or at a church and have Tyrone call in and speak to audiences, answer questions about his case and about what it was like to live on death row. And because of Tyrone's incredible ability to communicate, to dispel any myths about what a death row prisoner is like, to convey his humanity and his situation, these events have been incredible in terms of turning people around on the issue of the death penalty, dispelling all the myths pushed by politicians about how death row inmates are animals, how they deserve to die, how they represent a constant threat to the public. Tyrone has been an incredible agent in the ability to dispel those myths and to help rebuild the movement.
If people want to get in touch with the campaign to end the death penalty, where can they call?
There's a national number at 312-409-7145. I'm also urging people to contact Governor Glenn Denning's office and express their outrage. Maryland has one of the most racist death penalties in the entire United States, and they just killed Tyrone in violation of everything that they said about their requirements for the death penalty. It was a travesty of justice, and we shouldn't let it go unanswered.
Michael Stark of the Campaign to End the Death Penalty, a close friend of Tyrone Gilliam, executed last night in Maryland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion, Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Joe Gill engineered from Washington, D.C. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Michelle Garcia is our webmeister. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.